We've been talking about the Creator and the creature, and we've been looking at the sin that men have become involved in because they rejected or changed, and that word really means to exchange or swap. They made some bad trades. We've already seen two bad trades that men or mankind has made. First of all, they traded or changed the glory of the uncorruptible God, and that really means the glorious God that cannot be corrupted. And they changed that for an icon, for an idol, that they'd made with their own hands, fashioned after a four-footed beast or another man or a fowl or even a snake. And then the Bible tells us, as we studied this morning, that God gave them up to a vile kind of affection or passion. And God did this because in verse 25 it states they changed the truth of God into a lie. And here again, the same word means to exchange, to trade or swap. So they traded the true God for a lie, and that word is pseudo, and you've seen that many times as you've read. It literally means that which is false. So men, as they learned and knew of God, you said, but people in the early stages of man's existence, they had no knowledge of God. They had no revelation from God. But Paul tells us that these people did know about God. In fact, God revealed himself so adequately through the things that are seen that they were without excuse. That is, they had no legal ground to stand upon. And it wasn't a shadowy kind of ambiguous understanding of God, you know, that there's just some sort of being out there somewhere and we don't know who he is or what he is and we're not responsible to him. Paul said they could understand his eternal, not temporary, but eternal power and his Godhead, and because of this they were without excuse. Now the word Godhead literally means his God-likeness. It means all the attributes of God, which is not the Trinity necessarily, but all of the attributes of that which is deity. So these people had a tremendous amount of information. They were responsible to God, and they turned away from God. They didn't glorify him as God, and they weren't thankful. They became vain in their imagination. Their foolish heart was darkened. And they made these bad trades. This evening now, we'll look at another bad trade that mankind made. Let's look at verse 28. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient. These people that he's talking about now are people who have gotten involved in the most detestable sins that mankind can be involved in. The Bible tells us that they turned from God, that God literally handed them over to a particular thing. In verse 26, for this cause, that is for this reason, as a basis of what's about to be done, that is these things he's mentioned before, God turned them over unto vile affections. That means he turned them over to do the things that they had decided that they would do. And then the two things that are mentioned specifically are that the women did change the natural use, or that which nature teaches, into that which is against or unnatural, and that they involve themselves in the sex act, female with female. Now he mentions in verse 27 that they did the same thing in regard to men. That is, men did it. They left the natural use of the women and were set on fire in their lust one toward another. They work that which is unseemly, receiving in themselves that recompense of their error that was meet. And that word really doesn't give us the strong implication that it should. That which was meet literally means that which they deserved. And it has in it the idea that God recompensed them at that time, or in that time, with evidently disease and physical dissipation. Because this sin is of such a nature, that is the sin of lesbianism and homosexuality, are of such a nature that God judges them evidently in the physical realm earlier than the judgment seat of those who are lost because of the nature of the sin. And I read this morning from accounts in history of those writers in the ancient time who spoke of men being judged in the flesh because of their unnatural sex habits. Now, this evening we're looking at verse 28, which tells us that God gave them over this time to a reprobate mind. And even as they did not, now these are the people that were involved in these sins that I've mentioned previously, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, Romans chapter 1, verse 28, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient. What did God do when men began to practice these kinds of sins? And it seems there are just sort of three levels of descent that they moved downward. First of all, from just idol worship, then to changing the truth of God into a lie, and then to the lowest kinds of sins that were unnatural and repulsive to God and men. And because of this, then God is going to react to them. You know, the idea that God is not going to in any way react to the way we live and the things we do is an absurd idea. I know that God doesn't change his plans as he looks at what mankind does, but I can tell you this, that God always will be found in charge of things no matter what mankind does. That's what I mean. God will checkmate mankind every time. And when men think they've outsmarted God and left God out of their lives and everything will go well and God will never intervene again in their lives, they are seriously mistaken, because God will react to us oftentimes as man reacts to God. Not every time, but oftentimes. Now, and even as they did not like to retain God in their mind or in their thoughts, man literally kicked God out of his thinking. And even as they did not like to retain, this word means to test, to put to the test, to make a decision after a test. And this seems to be the idea that Paul's trying to get the Romans to see. That mankind, as the creature, put God to the test and looked at the results of the test, and then voluntarily, of his own will, kicked God out of his thinking. Now, this word knowledge means clear and exact knowledge, a knowledge that has not, that has an effect upon the knower. So this is not head knowledge, as we recall, as we often speak of it, as just they knew about God. But here it indicates that these people knew God in a very powerful way, a way that if they'd follow the knowledge that they had, they could change for the better. I think that's what Paul is trying to say. And these people involved in these acts that we've mentioned, they then literally kicked God out of their thinking, out of their knowledge, out of their minds. And God then gave them over to a reprobate mind. The word reprobate means a mind, or means anything. Here, nous, this word mind means, well, the inner thinking of mankind. It has in it the idea, the organ of mental perception, the organ of the consciousness preceding the act, the organ of moral thinking. And this word reprobate means something that won't stand the test. It has no end to it, no continuity to it. It can't be depended upon. So God turned them over to a mind or a way of thinking, if you please, that is unstable, that has no boundaries to it, and is without real benefit and help. And that is, their thinking now becomes totally without boundaries. And in this context, they're going to do the things which are not convenient. Now, this word convenient means befitting or fit or proper. So God turned them over. And this is the third time that we see that in this chapter of Romans. He gave them up or turned them over to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts. He gave them up unto vile affections. And this literally means that they were unclean in their heart and they were continually filled with lust. So God just turned them over to that. They were vile in their affections, so God just turned them over to their vile affections. Now, when they refused to keep God in their thinking, then God just turned them over to a reprobate mind to continue to practice those things which are indecent and sinful and ungodly. Now, here's what man is when he kicks God out of his thinking. What is a person like? What kind of lifestyle will they appropriate to themselves when they finally are bold enough to kick God out of their thinking? When the moral part of man is unwilling even to consider and to think about the things of God. Here's mankind who reject the knowledge of a holy God. And there are some 22 sins or defects or flaws. Some of them have to do with concepts. Some of them have to do with specific activities themselves. Now here, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, malignity, and whispers. Now, when he writes being filled, he literally means filled to the brim. These people are full. And it implies or teaches directly, I should say, that they don't simply indulge in these things when they're away from their church on vacation. That they hadn't been caught up in some sort of sin practice and then they've repented of it and quit. That's not what he's talking about here. It means just like you would take a container and fill it completely full, like a quart jar, and you filled it full of water, full to the brim, running over, and you couldn't put any more in it. This is the idea. These people are not occasional practitioners, but their lifestyle is totally filled up with unrighteousness. That which ought not to be. And it's really strange that it has in it that they ought not to do these things because the truth is revealed. We're not talking about people who don't know any better. And our social sciences today often point to people who have been reared in ghetto areas or reared in poverty, who have not had access to some of the institutions that perhaps wealthy or persons had access to. And we look at these people and we say, now look, we can't blame these people. They simply don't know any better. Let me tell you something. Every human being, now you listen to me, every human being has enough light that if he would have faith in that light and follow that light, he would be led to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. Now, you have to act on the light that you have. I didn't say you had enough light at the beginning. I'm saying that if you will act on the truth that's available and have faith and work on that truth, you'll be led to more truth until you'll be led to more truth until you'll be led to more truth. What I want you to really understand is that people today are without excuse. You said, well, now look, I know the people back at this time, God said they were without excuse, but he doesn't know anything about the ghetto areas of America. He doesn't know anything about the heathens that live in other parts of the world, and they're certainly not responsible to God. They certainly are responsible to God. You know, I think that Satan really knows a great deal more about how to discourage us and to get us depressed and to where we don't want to perhaps involve ourselves in his work, because if things are what they appear to be, we're just hopelessly whipped. We don't have a prayer. We don't have a chance. And here's what I have reference to. You know, many people have made the church totally responsible for every human that lives in the world, and that the blood of all the Chinamen that live in China is on the hands of Southwest Church, that all the blood of all the Russians is on the hands of Southwest Church, that all the blood of all the people that are in the world are on the hands of Southwest Church. And if we don't witness to them and if we don't win them, their blood's going to be on our hands. But I can tell you now, that isn't true. That isn't true. Paul said, I'm free from the blood of all men. Paul didn't preach to every human that lives in the world. He preached to the humans he came in contact with. Listen. The world is much more responsible to God than we've ever given it credit to be, I think. You know, we put ourselves down and said, look, you know, we're terrible. The church is an awful institution because look at all the world. It's going to hell. Now look, the world has a responsibility to seek God. Now, I'm not putting down our responsibilities to witness and to work. I'm just saying that the world has a responsibility to itself. And the idea that this is all on the church is an overpowering and oppressing. It just means we can't do it. Southwest Church can't witness to every human in the world. And therefore, we can't do the job that God gave us to do. And that's depressing and discouraging. But I think we can do the job that God's called us to do. We can witness to the people in the sphere of our influence. We can witness to people in India through the missionaries that are there. But we're not witnessing to the people in China. We're not witnessing to the people in Russia. There are millions of people that we're not witnessing to. What does that make us? Their blood's going to be on our hands. And they go to hell. They're going to be crying out against Southwest Church. I think not. I think not. Now, what men become who reject the knowledge of a holy God? Unrighteous, and they're filled with these things: fornication, wickedness, covetous, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, malignity, whispers, unrighteousness. This is what they become, even though they have revealed truth. Fornication. This is evil. And it's the evil that the sinful nature of man delights in. It comes from the wicked act of the mind. Covetousness means to have more. If you want to know a good definition of what it means to be covetous, it just means that you want more. What do you want? You say, well, I don't want any more. I don't want any more money. Do you want any more land? You want a bigger house? I mean, you want more. Covetousness is simply wanting more. Now think about that. You say, I'm totally satisfied with what I make at my job, except I'd like to have more. Right? I'm totally satisfied with what I have, except I'd like to have more. And we say, well, that's normal, that's natural. It might be covetousness. Maliciousness, bad. Every form of evil, the evil habits flowing from porneia. Envy, jealousy of another's success, depreciation of his worth, envy of his excellence, and associated with murder. Jealousy, or here, envy, which is translated jealousy in other places, has in it the idea of murder. Now, if you would kill in order to get more, then you are an envious person. That's the end result of envy, is murder to obtain. So envy is not one of those nice little sins that we've often thought it was. Murder literally means the killing of men. Debate means strife, rivalry, contention, wordy wrangling. I think that Matthew, a missionary that we support in India, has a good way of putting it. One day we were asking him about a couple of people who weren't getting along, and we asked him, said, are they having trouble? He said, not bad trouble, just mouth fighting. I knew immediately what he meant. Mouth fighting, wrangling, quarreling, malignity. That's evil disposition. The desire of evil to others, spitefulness. That's when we hope that something bad will happen to another person. Whispers. This is literally those who slander. Now, as I said, these are not occasional lapses. These are said to be filled full of these evils. Now in verse 30, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, and disobedient to parents. The word backbiting means speaking evil against another, a detraction. That is, someone might say to us, well, you know, this is a real good person and they do a good work. If we're a backbiter, we would point out some terrible thing they've done in order to detract from that which that person considers to be good in them. That's backbiting. Haters of God is a literal interpretation. These are people who despise God. You know, if you won't keep the things of God in your thoughts, then it certainly implies that you must be a hater of God. Despiteful means arrogant insolence, a mixture of pride and cruelty, contempt for others, enjoyment in seeing others suffer, and being willing to partake in it. And I think that would be a good example of a despiteful person would be the Germans in the period of the Holocaust, when they might not have partaken in evil behavior against the Jews, but they were glad it was happening to them. And I think when we see someone suffering and we enjoy it and would be willing to partake in adding more to it, then we would be a despiteful person. The word proud means self-sufficient. One who views himself above others, even God. Boasters, one who makes empty promises and false claims to gain for himself. Inventors, this means literally people who invent new forms of vice, new forms of sinning. And one of the world's most notable inventors of new forms of vice was Emperor Nero. And I might add that the early Christian martyrs were oftentimes used in the invention of cruelty. That is, they would think up what would happen if you took a lion that you'd starve for a long period of time and then put that starving lion with a human being. I wonder what would happen. And so they did it. What would happen if you tied a human being, one hand to a solid post, and then tied his other hand, say, to a horse? What would happen if you whipped that horse and lashed it? Would it pull his arms out, or would it pull his body apart? Suppose we inverted a human and tied one leg here and one leg there and between two horses. This is the kind of inventors of evil, but it certainly implies sexual sin also. People who literally thought up more and more ways to become despicable in their sexual behavior. Inventors of evil. Disobedient to parents. This means that they refuse to obey parents, and it has in it the idea of rebellion against parental authority. Verse 31. Without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful. Without understanding means void of understanding, or literally difficult. It's difficult for them to comprehend and understand. And it's difficult for them to apprehend people of this kind of lifestyle because their conscience is constantly seared with a hot iron. That's a very, I think, fruitful figure of speech. Their conscience is seared with a hot iron. And it has in it the idea of someone who worked, for instance, in forging metal, where they were working around a hot fire all the time, coals where they're blowing out of the furnace, perhaps those who make swords and other instruments of metal. And after a period of years not having worn gloves, their hands become just solid masses of tissue that has been scarred and has been rehealed and scarred and rehealed. And now they rarely feel a burn. They rarely feel the heat of the furnace because of continued searing of the flesh. You know, right now, if you burn your hand, it hurts for a long period of time. But if you worked around this kind of circumstance until you just did it over and over and over until you were an aged person, it'd soon get to where you could hold your hand right by the fire. A spark could fly over and hit. You wouldn't notice it. Why? The nerve endings are soon unaccustomed to that because of healing and scarring and rehealing. Now, when you continually practice the kinds of sins that are mentioned, that we've talked about last Sunday and this Sunday morning, if you continually practice those things, probably the first time, you're going to be so overcome with guilt and remorse, and you're going to flee from that scene of that sin, and you're going to say, "I'll never do that again. That was, oh God, forgive me. That's a terrible thing." But then the next time, there's hardly as much guilt and self-recrimination. Then after a period of time, you can do it without a guilty conscience. And then after a period of time, it gets to where you can not only do these things without guilt, you can do it and defend them orally from a soapbox and preach it. Just like the gay and lesbian organizations are doing today. These people, you say, don't their consciences bother them? Some of them, I'm sure, that their consciences never bothered them because of they've just practiced this sin so long that now not only they practice it conscience-free or guilt-free, they practice it boldly and assert that it's an alternate lifestyle. And that's because their consciences are seared with a hot iron. Now, without understanding, it's difficult to get people like that to understand who they are. Covenant breakers. That means they're faithless to an agreement. They're bound by no agreement. These people that Paul's talking about here, you could put a legal document before them and they'd sign it in a minute, but it wouldn't mean a thing in the world to them. All it is just a waste of time. They're not bound by a thing they've ever signed. And that's the idea of their lifestyle. Faithless to an agreement. Bound by no agreement at all. Without natural affection. Here's one definition of the word that's translated without natural affection. Unloving. Without tenderness. Now, here's what I want you to hear. It refers to the lack of the feelings of natural tenderness as seen in a mother who exposes or kills her child. Now, at this particular place in history in the Roman Empire, abortions were, of course, medically unknown from the viewpoint of the expertise that's been developed in the past 50 years or so. They did have a crude way of aborting a fetus, no question about that. But they usually, if they had a child that they didn't want, they just went ahead and bore the child, because an abortion was quite dangerous. But they'd bear the child and then take it to the city dump and leave it. And there was no law against it. It was not murder. You owned your child like you owned a dog or a horse. And so this is what this word has reference to. Mothers who can have an infant and then take the infant and just simply leave it on the city dump. It has in it the idea of a father who abandons his family. Here's a man who has a family, has children, he has a wife. They need him. They need what he can earn. They need what he can provide. He's the father. He was involved in the procreation of the family. He assented to the marriage. What's he do? Well, someday he just takes a left turn instead of a right turn, and he never shows up again without natural affection. And then children who neglect their aged parents. There's really three things that are involved here without natural affection. The mother toward her child that she abandons to die. The father toward his family who abandons them to want and deprivation. Or the children who, because their parents are aged and unable to care for themselves, simply abandon them to live in poverty and pain and then to die without natural affection. But none of these things affect our society today, do they? We're totally free of all these things, aren't we? There aren't mothers who don't care for their children, are there? There aren't fathers who abandon their families, are there? There aren't children who abandon their parents in old age, are there? Of course there are. So the idea that this describes an age of ignorance, before men ever became cognizant of the existence of God, that these are Neanderthal primates, perhaps, who had no knowledge of God. No, no. These are Homo sapiens. This is the thinking man. This is the civilized man. This is the man who developed literature, art, writing, commerce, cities, that kind of man. Now, implacable. That means without league or agreement, without respect for treaties. In other words, you can't ever settle a quarrel with a person who's implacable. It doesn't make any difference. You can have a problem with them. You can go to them. And it's like a country that would never settle their differences with another country. They just continually quarrel, and it didn't make any difference what you did. You could never get the quarrel settled. They intended to keep it alive no matter what. Unmerciful. It means without pity. It has in it the idea of active compassion, not just subjective compassion, but the idea of active compassion, not desirous of relieving the ills of others. It literally means you're hurting. Not only do I want you to hurt, but I could help you, and I'm not going to help you because I want you to hurt more. This is what we often speak of as man's inhumanity to man. Verse 32, who knowing the judgment of God? The word knowing here has in it the idea of knowledge. And it has in it the idea of looking on as a spectator, to know full well. The word judgment here means that which is declared right. Now let's look at it. Who, knowing, having, and possessing full knowledge that God has judged this behavior wrong, they which commit such things are worthy of death. This is what they know. They know, according to God, that doing such a thing, and the word commit means to do, to work, express in an action as continued, are not yet completed, denoting what one does habitually. That is involved in this habitual activity of this nature. They know that the judgment of God is going to fall upon it, that God is displeased with it, and that the sentence that God has executed or pronounced is death. That they which commit such things are worthy of death. Now, that's not the idea that they know that other people ought to be put to death for doing the things that are mentioned here, but they know themselves that God, in His pure judgment, would not be held accountable for their deaths because of their defiance of Him. Not only do they do these things, do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. Not only are they guilty of them, that is, these practices themselves, but they take pleasure. This means to enjoy in conjunction with others. Literally means they join in this kind of activity. They were fully aware of God's penalty for these sins. Yet with this knowledge, they went and did it anyway, and enjoyed doing it with others whom they encouraged in these same sins. And someone said this morning after service, "Brother Penn, I'm glad you mentioned what Paul said about the gospel, because these things are depressing. They're heavy. It's heavy. I understand it's heavy information. But how often do we talk about things like this?" You know, when these people at Rome got this letter, from what we can understand, they read it in church capacity, just like we are right now. They didn't divide the women and the children and say, "The women go over here and we'll read this letter. Men go over here and the boys and we'll read this letter." These were to be read in the churches. And they read the book of Romans in the church at Rome. Now, they didn't go through it like I have, trying to explain every word, because they knew the meaning of these words. And they were cognizant of what Paul was talking about. Although I'm sure there were later explanations made, just as I've tried to make them this evening. And this is what the Bible means when it enjoins a preacher to preach the word. It means that we feed to our flock every morsel that has fallen from the inspired pen of the writers of God's book. He said, "But I've never heard things like that. And Brother Penn, it's depressing and it's embarrassing. And I feel badly when I come to church and I hear things like this. I'd rather hear something much lighter and more encouraging." I'm not going to apologize for the inspired word of God. I'm not going to say, "Well, you know, God didn't, He didn't really want us to read this, and God really doesn't want us to understand this, and I know that we can skip over this and get to Psalm 23 real quick. We can get to John 14 real quick. You need to know this, and this is just as much the truth of God's word as John 3:16 is." He said, "Well, I don't want my child to hear things like this from a Baptist pulpit." They need to hear it. They'll learn from it and be instructed by it. You might not have ever talked to them about these kinds of sins, but God would have them know of His anger and wrath against these kinds of sins. The benefit? Well, the benefit is that Paul said, "I know when I come to Rome and I preach the gospel that it'll not embarrass me, that it'll do everything that God said it'll do. And it'll do it among people like these people that he's described. Now that's power. Can you imagine why Paul said, I'm anxious to get there. I'm ready. I'm committed to it. And I'll preach the gospel. Why? Because it's the power of God unto salvation. Did you ever realize that preaching the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ as a remedy for these sins is what Paul meant? Preaching the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ that satisfied the justice of God and made people who had been committing these sins righteous in the sight of God. How? By the application of his blood, by the sacrifice he made on the cross. Jesus Christ paid the penalty for all these sins, although he never committed a one. Never was guilty of a single one of these sins, and yet the penalty of all these sins were placed on him, and he died on the cross as a substitute for me and you. And that's why that even though we may have committed some of these sins and still in our weakness and our sinfulness still commit some of these sins, when God sees our spirit, we're justified in the sight of God, not by goodness, but by faith. Not by righteousnesses which we have done, but by faith we stand in the sight of God, not guilty, not having these things imputed to our account. Isn't it wonderful how God has provided for sinners? And Paul's going to finally come to this conclusion as he writes about all this, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. But the gospel is the remedy.